Om Pataya Pratibhutitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Yasena Pratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Nutavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashadashadhyayinim Amba Twamanusam Tadami Bhagavad-gītē
So let's start again with verse 23. Maybe we looked at it a little bit. We'll just go through that and then go on. Chapter 3. Om Tat Sariti Om Tat Sariti Nirdeshaha Om Tat Sariti Nirdeshaha Brahmanas Trividasmitaha Brahmanas Trividasmitaha Brahmanas Tena Vedascha Brahmanas Tena Vedascha Yajnascha Vihitapura Yajnascha Vihitapura Om Tat Sat Iti Nirdeshaha Brahmanaha Trividaha Smritaha Brahmanaha Tena Vedaha Cha Yajnaha Cha Vihitaha Pura. So it says these three words Om Tat Sat Iti present quote. So Om Tat Sat, these three words Nirdeshaha, they are designations. Trividaha, Nirdeshaha, Brahmanaha, Trividaha. They are threefold, means three words, Om Tat Sat, right? Om Tat Sat is three. So they are threefold designation for Brahman. Smritaha, they are recognized as, means in the tradition, for those who know the Vedas, for those who know the Shastra, it is recognized that this Om Tat Sat, these three words, Om Tat Sat, are designation for Brahman. He says, by that, the Brahmanas, means the priests in the caste system, the priests, the Brahmanas, the Vedas, the four Vedas, and the Yajnas are enjoined. By that Nirdesha, by that designation, which is threefold, what is said, the Brahmanas, the Vedas, and the Yajnas were enjoined at the beginning of time. Pura means formally, means at the beginning of the creation. We would say that Om Tat Sat, this designation, Om Tat Sat, is that from which the entire creation has come. And so this Om Tat Sat is considered to be very sacred. So the Brahmanas, if we talked just a little bit about this last time, the Brahmanas in the caste system, with the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Shudras, the caste system, caste system has gotten kind of a negative connotation, so we always call them varnas, that's the Sanskrit term, the four varnas. Means these are the way that society divides itself up. The Brahmanas are the teachers and the priests. That's what their role is, are the teachers and the priests. They're the ones who carry the knowledge of the Vedas, who in fact, the Brahmanas will put the Vedas to heart. And they know how to do all of the yajnas, all of the rituals. So these are the Brahmanas. The Kshatriyas are the warriors and the administrators, the government. The government and the armies, the warriors are the Kshatriyas. The Vaishyas are agriculture and business. And the Shudras are the support team that support all of those. And the secretaries and the nurses and all the people who come to help support. Those are the Shudras. Okay, so here, because the Brahmanas are the ones who are the holder of the Vedas is coming through the mouth of the Brahmanas, I'll say that at the beginning of the creation, you have this, the Vedas, right? The Vedas and all of the rituals and the Brahmanas kind of as a group. And so this whole knowledge, say, is something that came at the very beginning of creation with Prajapati as the creator, Brahmaji as the creator. So that being so, when the Vedas are looked at as the scripture, the scriptural basis for scripture is also kind of a negative word in our culture. But here, the Vedic culture, the whole Vedic culture is really, contains the whole Hindu, all of the Hinduism is contained really and has its roots in the Vedic culture. So even this knowledge, all of the Upanishads are Vedic. Right? All of the different Shastras, even the Vyakarana, the Jyotish, astrology, all of these things are from the Vedic culture. And so this Vedic culture has its roots in Ishwara. This is the idea. And with the beginning of, before the creation began, comes this sacred mantra, Om Tat Sat. Or we can say this mantra, Om Tat Sat. Each word is a designation of Brahman, the one from whom this creation has come. And so each one of these words, Om, Tat, and Sat, is a Nirdesha, is a word that designates Brahman, points to Brahman, the one from whom the creation has come. And so he's now in this last phase answering Arjuna's question. His question was this, just for the start of chapter 17. Say there's somebody who's doing nritya, doing rituals, they're doing different yajnas and rituals and tapas, but they're not really following the Vedas. Not against the Vedas, but they just don't have an understanding of all of the injunctions, all those things that are enjoined by the Vedas. So for instance, but they have Shraddha. They have Shraddha. If they have Shraddha, but they're not following the Vedas completely correctly, how are they viewed? Are they viewed, because they have Shraddha, are they viewed as being sattva, rajas, or tamas? They have Shraddha, but they're not doing it quite correctly. Not on purpose, because then they wouldn't have Shraddha. Say they were doing these rituals or praying to the Lord in with Shraddha and going against the Vedas at the same time. That doesn't make any sense. They have Shraddha, but they're not doing it correctly. They want to know, what does that mean? Is that sattva, rajas, and tamas? And so Krishna went through the whole of chapter 17 looking at what it means to do something, to do a ritual with that frame of mind, which is sattva, rajas, or tamas. Or food that you eat, sattva, rajas, or tamas. Tapas that you do, sattva, rajas, and tamas. You look at them from these three perspectives. But before he did that, he had a discussion about Shraddha. And what he said about Shraddha itself is that your Shraddha is deeper and underlies all of your attitudes. Because your Shraddha is your commitment, what you really hold to be true. If you have Shraddha in something, you hold that to be true, you have faith in it. Right? It's what you believe. Your Shraddha is what you actually believe. Sometimes you can't really account for what you believe, but it is nevertheless what you believe. And what you believe at that deeper level is what guides your choices. So that underlying Shraddha is most important. Right? And so he first did that kind of an analysis of Shraddha in terms of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Because Shraddha is, it's like saying Shraddha is who you really are, not as Brahman, but as a jiva. It's your guiding light, your value system. You know? And so that's why that very value system, what you value the most, is something so worth analyzing. Because what if your value system is askew? You know? The very value system is askew. That has to change before you can change what you're actually doing or how you're behaving in the world. Because how you're behaving in the world is actually in accordance with what you value, what you believe to be true. You know? And say for instance, you believe, because of the way you were grown, you were brought up or your culture, you believe that if somebody does wrong to you, you should retaliate. You should retaliate. That's what you believe. And so that's what you do. It's a big difference. Like this is the difference. Like say somebody does something to you, and just by instinct, you know, if somebody hits you, you want to hit back. But then you think, that's not my value. That's not what I want to do. And that was just instinctual. That's not my value, though. And so I will naturally work on not doing that. But now say, what if somebody hits you and your value is smash that person, kill them, get rid of them? That's the value. Then that's what you do, and there's nobody holding you back because it's going in line with your values. So say if the value system, what you actually believe, is sattvic, then you're going to be behaving in the creation in a different way than if it's rajas or if it's tamas. That's what he was saying. But no matter what it is, the shraddha, whether it's sattva, rajas, and tamas, that shraddha, right, is what gives energy to what you do. So far, so good? It gives energy to what you do. You know? Otherwise, there's no energy. There's a withdrawal of energy, in fact. So when you have shraddha, then there's energy going toward that. Okay, so this is important as we go forward for this Om Tet Sat. So first what we're going to do is look at what Om Tet and Sat means. Okay. So he says in this verse 24, Tasmat Om Ityudahritya Tasmat Om Ityudahritya Yajnadana Tapakriyaha Yajnadana Tapakriyaha Pravartante Vidanoktaha Pravartante Vidhanoktaha Satatam Brahmavadinam Satatam Brahmavadinam Tasmat Om Iti Udahritya Yajna Dana Tapaha Kriyaha Pravartante Vidana Uktaha Satatam Brahmavadinam. So his first word is Tasmat, therefore. Because this Om Tat Sat, right? Om is the first of this trilogy, Om Tat Sat, of these three. Because this is, the Om is considered the most sacred syllable, actually. And in the whole Vedic tradition, any ritual, any dana, any yajna, everything, any mantra, it always begins with Om. Like, for instance, any mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. Any ritual that we do begins with Om always. Okay? So he says, Tasmat, therefore, udahritya, having uttered, udahritya, having uttered Om, Om iti, so therefore, having uttered Om, the yajna, the rituals, dana, giving, tapas, austerities, kriyaha, he says, such activities, such actions as performing the yajnas, the rituals, the different charities, and tapas, all of these things that are vidana uktaha, that are enjoined by the Vedas. Vidana means enjoined. Upta, they are said as injunctions in the Vedas, right? These are the things that are to be done, and this is how they are to be done. So all these things that are enjoyed from the beginning, Vedas, they begin after having said Om. So this is just something, it's kind of interesting to see it here because it's so true. If you're in India, you see that any ritual, any greeting, all of these type of things, they all, in anything Vedic like that, it always begins with the Om. And Om, of course, is the name for Brahman, with the A-U-M. Right? The whole Mandukya Upanishad is Om. So Om is the name for Brahman, and Brahman with Maya Upadi that manifests as the physical creation, the subtle creation, and the causal condition. All of that is contained in the word Om. So he says, sometimes, does it begin with Om? Satatam, no. Always. It always begins with Om. Any Vedic injunction, whether it be any Vedic injunction, whether it be a ritual or different ways of doing tapas, religious austerities, or different ways of charity, giving charity, always these things begin with Om. If they're enjoined by the Vedas. According to who? Brahmavadinam, For those who are well versed in the tradition, in the Vedic tradition, so for those people who are familiar with the Shastra, who are well versed in the Shastra, they know this. Right? Always these Vedic injunctions begin with Om. So that's the first one. So it goes. Next one. Tadit janabhisandhaya palam yegnyata prakriyaha palam yegnyata prakriyaha dana kriyashtya vividhaha kriyante moksha kankshibhi iti anabhisandhaya palam yajna tapaha kriyaha dana kriyaha cha vividaha kriyante moksha kankshibhi. He's taking the second one. Tat. He said iti tad iti, that the udaharitya is understood having uttered tat, right? Then anabhisandhaya palam, having uttered the tat, not having any attachment to the result. I'll explain that. Anabhisandhaya to me is to be attached to or something. It's the palam, the result of your action or what you're doing. Having not an attachment to the result, then having uttered the tat, yajna tapa kriyaha, these actions, so the yajnas, the tapas, and related actions, and dana kriyascha vividaha, and also different varieties of dana. There's many different types of charity. So the yajna, the tapas, and related actions, and the different activities of giving, all of these things, kriyante, they are done by the moksha kankshibhi, by those people who desire moksha. Okay, so here, what they're talking about is for the mumukshu, the one who desires moksha, you may be doing rituals, performing rituals, but not so that you can get to heaven. You may be performing that type of ritual, like the Agnihotra, the various rituals that are done, but the reason that you're performing it is for Antakarana Shuddhi, right? Or you're giving charity for Antakarana Shuddhi. You're giving tapas for Antakarana Shuddhi. You're not doing tapas, religious austerities, to gain powers. Tapas can also be done to gain powers. They can be done to gain mastery over something, to gain powers, or to even gain riches or whatever. You can do austerities. What if the austerities that you're doing are not for any of that? Not for any type of shakti. Therefore, Antakarana Shuddhi. The rituals that you perform are just as performed for the sake of Ishwara, in order to please Ishwara, or just for your Antakarana Shuddhi. Dhanam also is only for Antakarana purity of mind. So it's not that these rituals don't produce results, but those results are not what you are doing the ritual for. So your prayer, your sankalpa, the sankalpa that goes along with the ritual or goes along with the charity, whatever it may be, or the tapas, is may I do this for Antakarana Shuddhi, or I do this for the pleasure of Ishwara. Another way that we say, I do this for the pleasure of Ishwara, I do this for Antakarana Shuddhi. Antakarana Shuddhi, really what that is, Antakarana Shuddhi, as a result, that comes really as a result of your jnanam, is the recognition. A mind that really has Antakarana Shuddhi there is no jiva there, in a sense. This body is Ishwara, the mind is Ishwara, the ahankar, the I notion is Ishwara, there's nothing that's not Ishwara. So this whole thing becomes Ishwara. Everything about you is recognized as Ishwara. Even the Atma is Ishwara. This self that you are, the self, the conscious being that you are, it is you, but that you is Brahman. This you that is you is Brahman. See what I mean? So we can say like this, I am Brahman, or Brahman is me. If I say, I am Brahman, it tends to keep you with the ahankara. But what if you recognize that this self that is you is Brahman? Right? So this self that I've always taken to be me, this individual self, is this self that is Brahman. This body that I have taken to be my body is actually part and parcel of Ishwara. But this body belongs to Ishwara. So I give this body back to Ishwara. This body that has always been Ishwara, it's always belonged to Ishwara, I give it back to Ishwara. The mind that has always been Ishwara, I give it back to Ishwara. You're giving to Ishwara what is Ishwara's. Right? You get the body is Ishwara's, and you say, yes, okay, the body is Ishwara's, you give it back. You give back what it's always had. But psychologically, there's a difference because there's knowledge behind it. Everything that you see, your sense organs themselves, all are Ishwara. Now, the thing is, now when we say that, so all of this is Ishwara, body, mind, senses are Ishwara. Where am I then? Where am I? Well, you are Ishwara. That's where you are. You are Ishwara. You're not this limited body, mind, sense organs. You are the whole. That's who you are. It's like trying, but the problem is huge. It's a huge transition from going from this identity with this limited body to an identity with the whole. Because think of the difficulty. If you have a vivid imagination of a meadow and you're walking along with friends in this beautiful meadow with animals and the trees and the grass and everything, you're walking along and you're a mumukshu. You're a mumukshu walking with your friends to the meadow. And you want self-knowledge. You want to know what's really going on, who you really are, as you're walking along in this meadow with your friends. Mm-hmm. And as a mumukshu, you attract to yourself, because you're really a mumukshu, you will attract the teacher, a real teacher. If you're a real mumukshu, you'll get a real teacher. If you're not a real mumukshu, you get a teacher that will fit what your needs. Say you say, I'm a mumukshu and I want to astral travel, then you'll get to astral travel. You'll get somebody that can teach you how to do that. But you're not really a mumukshu in terms of the way that we're using the term, but you'll get the teacher for what you really want. But say you're a mumukshu, then you will attract a teacher. And now that teacher has to make you see. And you're a mumukshu and you really want to see. You want to know. That's all you want, really. Everything else is secondary to understanding this. But you have to go, so the teacher has to take you, and you have to take yourself, because actually you're the one that has to be available for that knowledge. Mm. You have to take yourself from identification with the little person walking through the meadow to the recognition that your being is the self of the whole meadow, which is the truth. Just that in terms of your imagination, you are the meadow. You're not... You're every part, you're everything in the meadow, not one given thing. You're the self of the entire meadow, and all of the jivas in it, and all of the animals in it. The whole thing is you, is your being. And yourself is free of every one of those things. It's free of the whole meadow, and it's free of everyone in the meadow. But from the standpoint of the meadow, every single thing in the meadow is me. And from the standpoint of me, I'm totally free of the meadow. That's what this little guy has to see, you know. And the seeing, that seeing is not going to be the same as how I, the Ishwara of the dream, see the dream or see the imagination. The Ishwara of the imagination is so natural. There's no ajnanam there for me to have any problem with recognizing myself as the whole. Because the whole dream has, the whole imagination has come from me. You know, and I'm not identified with any given part of it. That's absolutely natural because no ignorance is there. I'm completely free. But this little guy who is totally surrounded, so embedded in ajnanam, in ignorance, because of the limitation of the sense organs in the mind, that one naturally, because of the sukshma sharira, because of the subtle body, totally enjoys consciousness. The subtle body pervades this body, physical body, and so in that little jiva, why would it not say, the mind of that little jiva, not say, I am the conscious being? And I'm looking at this table, and this table's not a conscious being. I'm looking at the space isn't a conscious being. And you're a conscious being over there, your little pocket of conscious being, and your little pocket. That's the jiva's experience. So look at the transition and the clarity that is required to be a jiva walking around in the little imagination and at the same time knowing I am the whole. For the Ishwara has no problem because there's no ignorance and there's limitless upadhi. The Ishwara of your little imagination has no problem. The Ishwara has no problem. No ajnanam, no ignorance is there, no limitation. But the jiva, now the jiva, when you get knowledge, as you gain knowledge, what happens is this, that in your experience right now, even though you are experiencing this world through the limitations of your limited mind and sense organs, you're not having an Ishwara experience of being identified with the whole infinite creation. You're not having that experience. But you are experiencing this room. And included in this room, this experience, is not only this known, everything external to the body is being experienced as part of the room. My body is being experienced as part of the room. My sense organs are being experienced as part of the room. My mind is being experienced as part of the room. This whole jiva is experienced as part of the room. And I recognize that all of this, everything, is objectifiable as part of the room, except for me, the conscious being that is not an objectifiable. That's a direct, immediate experience that I have. And that direct, immediate experience of conscious being, being the self of every experience that is there, but itself never objectified, never changing, always changeless, that experience is never negated at any time. It's always that way. It doesn't matter whether I'm having an imagination, or a memory, or a thought, or an I thought, or a perception. That's always the reality. All experience within duality is coming and going in the Satchitananda of myself. And so by logical extension, I can see that this is an infinite story. Like my little imagination is an infinite story from, in a limited way from my standpoint. From the standpoint of the jiva within it, it's part of a bigger story. I can see that all of this is taking place in conscious being. And nothing can shake that. The more I know, the more angles I understand that from, the more I see that this whole creation, without exception, is part of one conscious self. And so here, when for the mumukshu, I started this by trying to explain the problem, you know, how to get from this little jiva to, from you to be able to say, I am this jiva in this setting, to I am the self of this whole, you know. That's what we mean by antakarana shuddhi. Antakarana shuddhi is required, but that goes together. Knowledge and antakarana shuddhi play off against each other. They help each other. They build off of each other. Because as the more I understand, the less raga dvesha, the less likes and dislikes are there. The less likes and dislikes are there, the more my mind simply abides in the creation as it is, and I do whatever the dharma is at this moment. Because I'm not asking the creation to be in a particular way, because it's mitya. It's mitya. It is coming and going, changing. You know, changing in me. I'm the one who's stable. I'm the one who's the truth of the whole thing. Everything else comes into being, goes out of being, comes into being, goes out. It's like a kaleidoscope, like a huge mandala that is continually changing, 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 changing. And I find myself here. You know? But you, yourself, nothing's happening to you ever. And so what's your role in this changing kaleidoscope of mandala is to do what is there to be done. What is being asked of you in this situation? That's the antikarna shuddhi. That's what I think, what do I need to do in this situation? Not for my gain. It has nothing to do with gain. It has nothing to do with raga dvesha. It has to do with the fact of it. This is what is there to be done. Because I don't need the creation to make me full. Because that's my very truth, my very swarupa. So, those who desire the moksha, not with a tat, having said the tat, right? Tat means Brahman. Tat means that. Tat tvamasi. That, when it has nothing to land on, it lands on the reality, Brahman. So Om Tat Sat. So, all the yajnas, all tapas, all the kriyas, all the activities, all the dhanam, all the types of, it's all of the charity, all of those things are done without any desire for the result. It's only for, because that's what's being asked to be done, or I can say for antikarna shuddhi. Either for the pleasure of Ishvara, or just as an arpanam, as a worship of Ishvara, or because that's what's expected in the situation, but not for any type of personal gain, because the personal gain is the Atma. That is the personal gain. The personal gain is the Ananda, which is yourself. There is no other real personal gain that is real. Why that is real? Because that's what you seek. You seek existence, being that's not going to turn into death. You seek knowledge, which is absolute, the very source of knowledge. You seek ananda, love, wholeness, that feeling that I'm loved. That's ananda. Not loving or lover or anything like that. It's that absolute being loved. That's the ananda. That's the all well. All's well with me when I feel loved. But it's that finding the very swarupa of that loved, being loved. That's ananda. So, when I have that, then there's nothing else to have. Everything else is, it is what it is, but I don't need it. Because I already have what I wanted to get from all those things. Right? That's why. So, let's do the next one. Sat. Sadbhave, sadubhave cha. Sadbhave, sadubhave cha. Siddhityetatvayujyate, siddhityetatvayujyate, prashaste karmani tata, prashaste karmani tata, satshabdhaparatayujyate, satshabdhaparatayujyate, sadbhave, sadhu bhave cha, siddhityetatvayujyate, prashaste karmani tata, Sat Shabdaha Parta Yujite. He says, in reference to Sadbhava, the existence. So Sadbhava means two things. Sadbhava means coming into existence, something good coming into existence, or the being itself which everything enjoys. The being itself, the Sat, which everything enjoys, is Brahman. And also something coming into being, like the birth, they give the example like the birth of a son. That's a sadbhava. Something is coming into being. Right? The being is stable. The being is existence. But now, like a gift, this beautiful child is coming into being. So that's considered sadbhava. Something very positive coming into being. Or sadbhava is another meaning, is just the existence, the being that everything has. The being that everything enjoys, that's the sadbhava. Or the coming into being of something that's beautiful is considered sadbhava. Something, he says, asattaha sadbhave, like he says, asattaha sadbhave, like in the existence of something that was not there, yata, just as avidyamanasya putrasya janmani, just like in the birth of a son who was not there before. Right? The son comes into being. And so that's sadbhava, as well as, he says, as well as existence itself. And another meaning for this sat is sadhubhave. It's in the sense of sadhubhave. That's in the sense of becoming a good person. So something good coming into being, or sadhu, means the coming, the becoming a good person, sadhu bhava, the moving in toward the good. So he uses the example of, you know, a person, an adharmic person, or a person who has things to work on, transforming into a beautiful person. That's also, so that transformation into the good is called sadhu bhava. So he says, in these two senses, sad, either existence itself or the coming into being, or sadhu bhava, the coming into being of the good, something of transformation of goodness, coming into being of the good. Sat iti etat prayujate. The sat is used in this way. Okay. So also one of the things he says, prashaste karmani, also in sacred karmas, rituals, like for instance, he uses the example of a marriage ritual. It's a sacred ritual. So the word sat is used in reference to these things, sat. So he says, tata similarly. So sat shabdha parta yujate. So similarly, the sat bhats, the word sat, he parta yujate, is used in this way. So sat, so om tat sat, he's just giving a couple of ways that the sat is being used. And now he gets one more. Let's do that, see the other ways. Yajne tapasi dhane cha. Yajne tapasi dhane cha. Stitif sad iti chochate. Stitif sad iti chochate. Karma chaiva taratiyam. Karma chaiva taratiyam. Siddhite vabhidhiyate. Siddhite vabhidhiyate. Yajne tapasi dhane cha. Stitihi sat iti cha uchate. Karma cha eva taratiyam. Sat iti eva abhidhiyate. So now he says another meaning for sat. He's just going on giving a little bit more. The word stiti means staying in. It means like a commitment. So when there is a commitment toward yajna, the rituals, or you have commitment toward tapas, or a commitment toward charities, that's stiti. You're staying there, you're committed there. The sad iti cha uchate, sad, the word sad is used in that way, in reference to your commitment toward your yajnas, tapas, or dhanam, that devotion or commitment to it. Or karma cha eva tadartiyam, or toward any karmas that you may do that are devoted to those things. Maybe I'm doing special karmas for a yajna, or special karmas for tapas, or special karmas for dhanam. Also, that those karmas themselves are called sat. Or I can say that the tadartiyam is, I'm doing these karmas for the sake of Ishwara. Where the tet refers to Ishwara. So it's either the karmas that I'm doing in order to, I have commitment to, or I'm the karmas that I'm doing for the sake of Ishwara, where the tet stands for Ishwara. That's also another meaning. So he said, sat iti eva abhidhiyate. These are other ways where these things themselves, they are called, designated as sat. Okay. So what he's just done is taking om tet sat. It's in a way, it's just, if you were in the Vedic culture, everything that they're saying here, you would think, oh yes, that's true, that's how these words are used. But in the Vedic culture, these om tets, the words om, tet, and sat are pervasive in a very important way. Like if I say tet tvamasi, you know, that tet refers to Brahman. If I understand tet in certain usages, it's always referring to Brahman. Sat is always referring to being, to existence. And he's elaborating on it, how these words revolve around Brahman and Ishwara in just different ways to bring that to your mind. And so what he says is when this om tat sat, let's do this last verse, then I can wind this up, that is what I want to say. Ashraddhaya hutam dattam Ashradaya hutam daptam tapastaptam kritam chayat tapastaptam kritam chayat asat idyuchate parata asat idyuchate parata nachatat prajano iha nachatat prajano iha. So first he introduces in the verse 23 this Om Tat Sat, how important this is. But at the end he says, Ashradaya Hutam. The offering in a ritual, an offering that is made, Ashradaya without Shraddha. Adbektam, Dhanam, charity that is given, Ashradaya without Shraddha. Taptam, Tapas Taptam, austerities that are performed without Shraddha. Kritam, actions that are done, those actions that are done without Shraddha. Asat iti uchate, they are all called asat. Okay, Heparta. And nachatat prajna, after death, there's nothing. Naha nau iha, nor also here. What that means is, it's really, in the end, it answers Arjuna's question. Whatever you do, if it is not done with Shraddha, it becomes asat, non-existent. What that means is that anything, the reason that you're doing it for, the gain that you're trying to get from the performance of that ritual, or the performance of the tapas, or the performance of the charity, or the performance of any dharma, whatever it is done, if it's done without Shraddha, then it's as though it doesn't exist. Means there is no pala for it. Yeah. There's not something negative that happens. It's just, if the Shraddha isn't there, that ritual, that charity, that tapas is not efficacious. Nothing happens. There is no result. The result is asat. And so, the tradition is, as if you, and Swamiji writes about this in his commentary in Shankara, as long as, say if you're performing a ritual, or you're doing tapas, or you're doing dhanam, and the Shraddha is there, whatever the ritual, the Shraddha is there, Before the ritual, you say Om Tat Sat. Before the dhanam, you say Om Tat Sat. And after you say Om Tat Sat, after it's over, with Shraddha, then whatever limitations there were to that ritual that you were performing, whatever errors that you made, whatever, even if you were doing it with some rajas, whatever was there, if you say the Om Tat Sat with Shraddha, before and after, then that ritual is blessed. That ritual is viewed as though perfect. Another way we can say is, if you're doing, Krishna is saying, almost like a crutch, you know? You say Om Tat Sat with Shraddha, and then you can feel secure and safe that Bhagavan will receive these rituals and this tapas in the proper way. But now you know, okay, you say that with Shraddha, and you'll be okay. Even if your swaras are off or whatever, it'll be fine. Say Om Tat Sat before and after with Shraddha. If you do any ritual or any of these things without Shraddha, there's nothing. If you say Om Tat Sat without Shraddha, there's nothing. So really the truth of the whole thing is, to answer Arjuna's question, he's saying the Om Tat Sat is nice with Shraddha, but the truth of it is that if you are doing something with Shraddha, then that will be efficacious. What makes your ritual or your giving efficacious is the Shraddha with which you do it, you know? And so if that Shraddha, and by Shraddha we mean Shraddha which is sattvic, the Shraddha which is rajas and tamas is kind of a worldly Shraddha. It means I'm doing this for you, so you'll do this for me. You know? And if you have a commitment, you'll probably get that. You know, but we're talking about sattvic Shraddha, you know. Satvika means that that belief is there in the efficacy of the ritual, in the efficacy of the Vedas, in the efficacy of the Tamas, in the efficacy of in the truth of Ishwara, the reality of Ishwara, that Shraddha is there. And then it doesn't matter if you make this mistake or that mistake. You know?
Mm.
You'll be blessed because of the Shraddha. In the end, what is important is that Shraddha. And that's what he's saying. So just chant Om Tat Sat before and after. Swami told me that. He didn't say, because I used to worry that I wouldn't have my pronunciation would be just right. And he said, you just make a sankalpa before and after. He didn't say Om Tat Sat. You know, Om Tat Sat's very nice. You know, but the Om Tat Sat, there's a sankalpa there. There's Shraddha there. It's please accept this gift or my giving, or please accept, you know, this offering, this ritual, as though it's done perfectly. As though it's done with perfect Shraddha, with perfect pronunciation, please accept it in that way. Yeah, so then you don't have to worry about it. But your Shraddha is there. It's very beautiful. It's you're tuning in to your Shraddha, to what you really believe, what is important to you. And that's what is really blessing the ritual. And that's how he answers Arjuna after having taken him on this long ride of Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas and the different attitudes that we can have toward what we do. If the attitude is sattva, it's good. If it's rajas or tamas, it's very worldly and can be very dark and not going to give you the things that you want. You know, like say if you're giving in a rajasic way, I give to you, you give to me. I give to you because I want you to respect me and think I'm a great giver. That's rajasic dhanam, you know. I'm doing this ritual so that you can look at me and say, oh, what a religious person she is. I'm not doing them because for Ishwara's, you know, that pritiartham, the pleasure of Ishwara, or for my worship of Ishwara, you know, or with Shraddha. I'm doing it so other people will look at me and think that I have Shraddha. Yeah, that's rajas. And tamas is when I'm doing all of these type of things, often to hurt myself or somebody else, to gain power. So that's why he talked about the rajas and the tamas as things to just see. That if those motivations are there, to look at them and correct them. Because we are mumukshus. We wouldn't be here if we're not mumukshus. It's all about consciousness. Looking inside and seeing, you know, what things are a little off. And then it's okay. We have lots of things that are off. It doesn't matter. The good things we're working on them all. So that's what's beautiful. So. Om Tat Sat. That's this chapter. Do you have your thing there, Edward?
Huh?
Let me see that for a minute.
The closing.
Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Upanishad Su. Upanishad Su. Brahma Vidyayam. Brahma Vidyayam. Yoga Shastre. Yoga Shastre. Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, Shraddha Traya Vibhaga Yoga Nama, Shraddha Traya Vibhaga Yoga Nama, Saptadasho Jayaha, Saptadasho Jayaha, says this 17th chapter, Sapto Jayaha. A nama which has the name Shraddha Traya Vibhaga Yoga means it concerns the threefold division of Shraddha, Sattvika, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, the threefold division of Shraddha. This 17th chapter, which is in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, which is viewed as an Upanishad, Upanishad Su. Which is Brahma Vidya, That's its subject matter, Brahma Vidya. And it is also a yoga shastra, means karma yoga. So in the Bhagavad Gita, which is viewed as an Upanishad, whose subject matter is the Brahma Vidya, and which is a yoga shastra for karma yoga, in this dialogue, this teaching, samvada means guru-sisha relationship, the dialogue between a guru and his student, guru-sisha relationship, samvada, between Krishna and Arjuna, this is the 17th chapter called the Threefold Division of Shraddha. That's the name of the chapter. So Om Tat Sat. Notice it says Om Tat Sat, Om Tat Sat.
Yeah.
So Om Tat Sat, that's the 17th chapter. Swasti prajabhyah paripalintam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shivamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamsho varahitah Brahmanasantu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma satgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amatam gamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
So,
Michael,
The first verse we did, verse 23, and the last one, verse 28,
yeah,
each in a different way, for me, they're having a negative effect on my Shraddha.
Well, maybe
I should talk to you privately about this, but the first one, it has to do with the Varnas, whether you call it that, or the caste system.
Varnas, yeah.
What do you call them?
Varnas.
Varnas, yeah. Yeah. And it seems to fly that whole system in the face of Ahimsa.
Why?
Because the people at the bottom, I don't think they're very happy with the system, especially untouchables.
Well, you're bringing in, I think that's true, but if you go back in time, I don't think it's like that. Here the Brahmins aren't looked at as superior or inferior. It has something to do with the Vedas, the ones who are like in an oral tradition, but there's no writing at all. Right? And so the Vedas were something that were coming out of the mouth of the Brahmanas. They were held in the minds of the Brahmanas. That's all that's meant there. Like you can say, if I can say, the Brahmanas stands for the whole caste system, but it means the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. If you look at it, the way the world divides up, the way people divide up, they're just broad categories for what people do. If I were to say, if everybody has different types of work, this group of work goes into here, this type of work goes into here, this type of work goes into here. These are people who say, people who are in agriculture and business, we call them Vaishyas. People who are in government and war, warriors or whatever you call them now. Yeah, all of that, whole politicians, the warriors, all of that, they go into the group called Kshatriyas. The servant class, people who serve all of those, go into what we call Shudras. In fact, the Shudras are not untouchables. Shudras are Shudras. They're part of the system. Untouchables, what we mean, they're mlechas. The untouchables are people who are not part of the system. They're not contained within that Vedic culture. And so say somebody comes in from outside of the culture, they don't have any of the same values or at all, anything. They're called mlechas. We say untouchables, but I don't think they say, that's an English word. Just, these people are not included. They don't include themselves. They're not part of the Vedic culture. Those are the mlechas. Right?
We don't have an equivalent in our
culture. No, because it's a cultural concept.
Mm. But isn't it true they can't eat in the same restaurant and so on? I mean,
I don't know.
Doesn't that kind of stuff happen?
Probably.
I mean, it's sort of like segregation in this country.
Yeah, but these are the dark ages. You know, it's like, say if you, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add to what you're saying based on my understanding is that they used to mean what your capacity was or what your propensity was. Just like you can take the SAT and figure out if you're more verbal oriented or more mathematical oriented. It wasn't until much later that it became a system that you were born into. It used to be just about what your best capacity was, and that's where you fit into what your best capacity was, how you could make the best contribution to society. And I think that the way it works now is a bastardization of that, in that now you're born into a particular category instead of what your best capacity actually is.
Well, somehow I think they talk about it a little bit differently than that. That you can be born into, because your family is a given caste, a given varna, you're born into that varna. So by varna, by birth, you're that Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. But then by guna, you're something else. Like you could be a Kshatriya who by guna, by capacity, is a Brahmana. Or you can be a Shudra who by capacity is a Brahmana or Kshatriya. They talk about this in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Mm. You know, and so there's crossover in that way. But as far as I know, the caste system was something that was carried on by birth. In other words, you were born into your caste. And they would look at it like, this is, they have other ideas too, like, I mean, I have these same ideas, it's not they don't. That this life is just one life of many. And you're born into that family because that is who you are. Your karma's put you into that family. You know? And so say you're born into a Kshatriya family, it's because you have your Kshatriya by guna at the time of your death, and so you'll be born into a Kshatriya family. If you're Shudra by guna, you'll be born into a Shudra family during that time. But now the thing is, everything has its dark side. And in this era, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of prejudice. Now there's a huge backlash prejudice against the Brahmanas. You know, there's a lot of dark stuff happening. It's corruption. You know, it's a corruption of an archetype. So the archetype is pure. Mm-hmm. But then the archetype becomes corrupt in as it plays out in the world over time. This is Kali Yuga. This is the most corrupt era that we can be in. It's Kali Yuga, and we're going deeper and deeper into it. So we're all swimming in a dharma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't seem like this system could ever be realistically, practically applied in a way that wasn't causing a lot of suffering for people.
I don't really agree with that, but I think that might take a lot of discussion on our part. Mm.
With humans. I just don't see how it could work.
I think that, well,
you
it's not working now. Let's put that.
You can kind of think of it almost like there right now we have an environmental crisis, right? So there's all kinds of bizarre practices that are leading to the destruction of the planet. Well, there's also the human environment. Things are not running in an orderly fashion in the human environment. And there supposedly there have been higher ages when there's been more harmony with the environment and the human environment. You know, if people are prayerful, you know, and if they're more people are basically they enjoy what they're doing and there's a better matching between your circumstances that you're born into and what your natural inclinations are.
When did that occur? Because I don't think you go back in human history, there's been suffering. People have murdered each other. They've murdered animals. They've been doing, I mean, the suffering that's happening nowadays isn't new. It's not in the past 10,000 years. Or
that's why I love to read all the ancient epics, because everything that's happening now is happening then.
Yeah.
Even in those epics, like if you have the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, there's still the war between good and evil.
Yeah, there's nasty people doing bad things.
Oh, yeah. There's asuras and rakshasas.
Well, I wonder if that's why Shiva came down as a dog eater when Shankar was walking, and then the dog eater walked across his path when he did it. And
Shankar said, getcha,
yeah,
go.
I wonder if that was a way of Shiva neutralizing that whole... whole duality, you know, because of a smoke shower, really.
Yeah, I mean that's getting to the truth of it, but I don't know. I can't argue with you because it's a long discussion, and I don't think you really know that much about.
I don't know.
Yeah, so it's just pushing some buttons in you, but you don't have a big enough picture, and I can't give it to you tonight because it's too late.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the other one that concerns me is Om Tat Sat correcting problems with the swaras and so on. It doesn't seem to me that would even be an issue in the first place. I mean, to say that prayer is effective, to the extent that we know that, to the extent that there have been studies on that, they haven't been, I don't know of any that have been done with Vedic prayers, they've been done with other kinds of prayers, which will completely violate everything here. And they didn't say Om Tat Sat at the beginning. They don't have Shraddha in any of this stuff. But it still can be...
But they still had Shraddha.
In something.
In something, that's all. They had Shraddha.
Right, so some of the detail here, it seems kind of unnecessary to say to have a specific word that you say, or to follow a specific thing, as long as you have an intention and a belief.
That's true. But that's just what I was saying at the end, right? In the whole thing, it comes down to Shraddha. That's what it comes down to, is the Shraddha. And say in this country, if you're doing some prayers can be very, very powerful, but not if there's no Shraddha. It'd be nothing. But the Shraddha is there, yeah, they will be powerful.
And so the question is, what does the Shraddha need to be in? It doesn't necessarily need to be in the Bhagavad Gita.
No, it doesn't.
Just in the fact that
but
this
why are you even saying this?
Effective.
Why are you saying this? Because this Bhagavad Gita is something that exists within the Hindu culture only.
Right.
And I'm sharing it with you.
Right.
You're in the Western culture.
Right.
So it's not saying that, oh, because you're in the Western culture, whatever you're doing doesn't count. This Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads take place within the Hindu culture. They have something to say. We have to translate it into our own culture. But if you can't kind of put yourself into their cultural context, then it's hard to understand what they're saying, because the Bhagavad Gita was written a long time ago. Right? Long time ago.
And within a specific culture.
Within a specific culture. And so you have to be able to translate to this era what is useful, because truths are timeless. There are certain things you have to let go of, but they're saying something very important. But if you can't translate, then it's kind of like, oh, they're saying this and they're leaving me out. Because you're not...
Well, that's one way to look at my question, but that's not the whole of it. part of what I'm saying is, you know, it seems like we need to, for me at least, is to not necessarily take on that, well, the Vedas are the only way to go. You know, that it is, for example, here, I don't have to say Om Tat Sat for any prayer that I would say to be effective.
Right, you don't.
Yeah.
But I just even said that tonight, didn't I? That what was important was the Shraddha.
You did say that. But you also said the other thing, that, I mean, you were saying what was here, but I'm wanting to be really clear for myself that it is just the Shraddha, and it doesn't mean Shraddha in the specifics of the Vedas necessarily, at least what we're talking about.
Well, what I said exactly was that Shankara, which, like Swamiji said, when I wanted to make sure that I was chanting these swaras correctly when I'm learning to chant, and when I teach you, I'm very specific. I want it to be chanted correctly with proper pronunciation, because that's how they do it in India, and they have a real value for it. But they also will make a sankalpa to that, please accept these prayers as though they're being done, chanted properly. So Swamiji said, just make that sankalpa, however you want to say it. Because I want to do those prayers properly, because it's highly valued in India that they be done properly. The swaras and the way that the chanting is done is considered to be very important, even for the efficacy of the chant itself. That's part of that tradition. And I'm part of that tradition, and so I respect it, and I want to do that. But it's not saying anything about the way we pray over here. Over here, if you say, Our Father who art in heaven, say you say that's a well-known prayer, and you say it with Shraddha, that has one power to it. But if you just are flipping it off, it has nothing. There's no effort. That punya, that shakti isn't there in it, if there's no Shraddha. Mm-hmm. That's what's being said, right? It's not a comment on you or on the West or on any other culture. This is a tradition, right? That within mm-hmm. that tradition there's a certain teaching, there's certain values, and there's something to understand there. You don't have to become an Indian. You don't. You don't have to become an Indian. But there's something to understand that's very ancient and true, you know. But if you look at it from the outside, like, well, they're saying this and I'm over here, then you're not really using it in a way that's helpful.
I guess what I'm saying is, for me, I need to filter some things out of this, out of the literal words that are being said, in order for it to make sense.
Yeah, you do. Some of us filter naturally, but you're needing to spell it out, which is fine.
Right.
Yeah, some of us make kind of a natural translation. You're not making that natural translation.
No.
You need to define it, which is fine.
It's kind of like Joseph Campbell. Makes me think of Joseph Campbell, where he was like, he talked about how the hero appears in all these cultures.
Right.
So, yes. And kind of thinking like that.
Right? Well, I think that's good, actually.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because there are... The Vedanta and the Vedas, they have very profound truths. But your mind has to be kind of, you do have to translate, because you're not brought up in that culture. And if you can't kind of translate with ease, it's going to be always you over here and them over there, instead of being able to feel your way to the truth of the whole thing.
I guess part of why I'm reluctant to do that is that I've seen so many people who are very facile with that, and to me appear to have really misinterpreted, and they kind of get it wrong, like some of the teachers out there nowadays. You know, they say, oh, this is it, I got it. There was a teacher here last week who held a book in her hands. It was a Tibetan thing, but and she understood everything that the book was saying from that. She's claimed during this talk she gave. I wasn't there, but I heard it from other people. And that, and you know, and then she's going off, and people are like leaving. And
but how does that apply to what we are doing? I
don't totally trust my own capability to look at everything that's in all of the Shruti and say, well, I just can read that and get it. Why would I need a teacher then? You know, if I could just go through and get the heart of it without having to
But you do have a teacher.
I do, and I also need to do manana.
Yeah, I know. But
as part
of
that.
You do have a teacher. I hope. I mean, I'm here.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so,
no, I
so, and we've been very, very deeply involved in this tradition, in teaching it traditionally.
Yes.
And so you are being given this tradition as it's been passed down forever.
With some changes.
Not really. Well, I don't know what you mean by changes there.
We're not wearing robes. You're a woman. I mean, there's significant...
I'm talking about the teaching.
Okay.
Not the dress or things like that. The teaching itself.
There's a lot that's traditional in what you're doing. I think in some ways you veer from tradition too.
Well,
I'm not criticizing those.
Well, okay, it depends. Now, what you mean by tradition, if you're talking about how we dress... That type of thing, I'm not veering from tradition. I'm not trying to be an Indian. That's not veering from tradition. I don't have to be an Indian. What the tradition is how this Shastra is being taught. And if I'm veering from tradition, I would be very concerned about that. That means that what I'm saying is not in line with the Shastra, it's not in line with my teacher, it's not in line with the whole Sampradaya. I would be very, very concerned. But if you think veering from the tradition is because I'm a woman, in fact, that isn't even true. In the Brahma Sutras, in the first sutra, the question is, Atato Brahma Jignasa, now therefore the study of Brahman, the desire to know Brahman. That's the first sutra. And in the commentary of that sutra, they talk, well, who is it that can have that desire to know Brahman? Who can be a mumukshu? Who's qualified to be a mumukshu? Is it only a brahmana? Is only brahmanas, are they qualified to be mumukshus? What about women? What about them? What about shudras? What about mlechas? Amen. What about the mlechas, the untouchables? Are they qualified? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, the person who is qualified to know Brahman is a mumukshu, no matter where they're from. They can be a mlecha, means that they're not born in the Hindu tradition. They can be a woman. They can be any of any caste. They can be any... The qualification is the mumukshutvam. That is it. You know, and so I'm qualified.
And I'm not questioning that.
No, I know you're not. But I'm saying that I'm qualified. You are all qualified because you're mumukshus. That's your qualification. For this knowledge, you may not be qualified to perform a ritual unless you're married, or you know, there's certain rituals that you can do and certain rituals that you can't do because of your stage in life or because of your caste and all that, certain things that are open to you and not other things that are not, certain ways that you dress and all of this type of thing. That's all different than what we're doing.
May I share my reflections on Om Tat Sat? To me, it just seems like, and I'm using this article specifically, an anchor point or a focal point. And I'm using that article specifically, a, meaning that there could be others. For you to do something intentionally, to start it with a focal point. And what this tradition is offering is to start it with Om Tat Sat. The point being is
if
that
it has meaning to you.
If it has meaning to you. And if you have something else that has meaning to you, that serves as this focal point for the intention for you to do something intentionally, then that's all that's important. But what it's offering is that you have that, whether it be Om Tat Sat or, you know, Hare Krishna or, you know, whatever it would be in any particular
religion
or viewpoint. I think that's what's being offered that maybe shouldn't be missed based on the specificity of the tradition. It doesn't have to be Om Tat Sat. But what does Om Tat Sat mean in this tradition? It's a focal point for intention setting.
That's really good.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to add, originally, my interpretation of it is the personal intention that I am going to be doing my best. So it's acknowledging that this was my best.
And acknowledging your shuddha.
Yeah, and it's not a free pass to be lazy about it. It's just saying this was my best. And I'm acknowledging that the intention behind it, regardless of how perfect it was or not, was as pure as it could be.
And I actually think they have these, I like this idea of focal point, that's they have this in many different religions and many different tribal things. Even Jung talks about it. If they're blessings,
yeah.
You know?
I just have a very small question. The three words are synonyms representing maybe slightly different qualities of the same thing. They're not in relation to each other when you say it that way. It's not like a sentence.
I know it's not. They're three different words for Brahman. Om,
yeah.
Tat Sat.
Yeah.
And it's just considered sacred. But it can be any sankalpa. But just like, say we, the whole Mandukya Upanishad, the whole thing is around the sacred syllable Om. So that once that's been studied, when you say the word Om, it has this huge, it has a whole vision in it. But it doesn't have the vision in it if you don't know it. You can be walking around saying Om, 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 it doesn't mean anything to you. But if you've understood what it means, then when you have this one syllable, you say Om, it brings the whole vision to your mind.
Mm.
You know? So say you make a sankalpa before you do a ritual. You could make a different sankalpa every time. You know?
Mm.
Or the words Om Tat Sat, if you like those words, they can be loaded. The words are loaded with your whole knowledge, with your whole understanding, and they bring about that, what we call that bhava, that heart with which you're doing the ritual.
So my question is, do you see a value in having a focal point? Because I think that's the core teaching here in this chapter. And that maybe
the core teaching is that whatever you do, it has to be done with shraddha for it to be
efficacious. And it's offering Om Tat Sat as something to...
To hold that.
To hold it.
Yeah.
To begin something intentionally. And if you happen to find what that is and works for you, and then you start doing it with every action that you do, then every action you do is loaded with shraddha.
With that shraddha.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the difference between sankalpa and shraddha?
A sankalpa is just a resolve. Like you can make a sankalpa, every day I'm going to do such and such. Right? But say you have no shraddha in that sankalpa.
Okay.
You see, then the sankalpa doesn't have any power.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So even the fake it until you make it could be shraddha still.
Well, the fake it until you make it. See, that's another really important thing to understand. We say that, and Swamiji says it with tongue in cheek, fake it until you make it. But actually, you're not faking it.
No.
It, because your value system is one thing, but your habitual response is another.
Mm-hmm.
And so you make your habitual response, you push that aside, even though that's what you want to do, in order to and put forward your value system. So you're, in a way, faking it from the standpoint of not of holding back on what you feel like doing. But you're not really faking it. You're containing what you don't have a value for and putting forward what you do have a value for. See what I mean?
It's my understanding that was something that he liked about AA. Right? I think that's a phrase that they use in AA.
Is it?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
He liked that.
Yeah.
He appropriated it. He said, that's right.
Yeah.
That's what you should do.
But fake it to make it.
Yeah. But you have to remember what that means. live up to your value system, even if you're wanting to behave in a different way, you know?
I think it's a practice until your value system and your behavior can be in alignment with each other, because sometimes your natural inclination is to not behave in a way that is in alignment with your evolving value system.
And so you feel like you're faking it because you want to do something else. And you're holding back on what you really want to do and putting something forward that is not really how you feel. And so you feel like you're faking it, but actually you're living out your value system and trying to control this other way of being that you don't have a value for. Other way of behaving.
There's something called a covage that it often occurs before a longer prayer or something like that, that I was told was like a shield, kind of like it's asking, okay, I'm about to recite this and, you know, it won't be perfect, but...
That's exactly it. So what is it called?
A covage.
And in what religion is that covage?
Well, I learned about it from, you know, in...
Is it Jewish?
In India. No.
Oh, covage.
A covage. Or a kavicha?
I don't know, I'm not familiar. Okay. But that's the idea.
Yeah. Maybe in Hindi. Yeah.
I like what you said about the Shraddha in the beginning. You know, the commitment piece that's part of that. And the value. And, you know, I really felt like, and I actually observe this also myself. I mean, I observe this all the time, every day. And I feel like, you know, like, it seems like this Om Tat Sat is kind of like what you already said, this embedding the Shraddha with some extra, yeah, like embedding it.
It's a little home for it.
Yeah, and with some extra insight, you know, to value its relevance. Yeah, so seems like it's really true. I think without that true from the heart Shraddha, it's all just empty stuff, you know? You pray and it's like utterly meaningless, you know? Like you were saying, it's utterly meaningless, but I just realized this moment, it's true, it's totally utterly meaningless. Because it's not doing anything. Yeah.
You okay?
Mm-hmm.
One thing about the Sankalpa is that it doesn't have to be Om Tat Sat. And for me, I just didn't, thinking about this Om Tat Sat now that we're doing this chapter. I've never done Om Tat Sat before and after. But I always did, not always, but usually, do make some sort of a Sankalpa. Because it focuses you, you know. It brings your value system, it brings your Shraddha into the room, into the prayer. Or you're wanting to have Shraddha even though you don't. wanting to have a lot of feeling even though you don't, you know. Wanting your heart to be in it even more than it is. So you set that up. Please accept it as in this way, until I can really open, really live up to that.
Well, there's something about it that acknowledges the value for doing, for the sampradaya as it's handed down, for getting it right, because there's a lot of razzmatazz, you know, in other teachings where it's gone off a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit someplace else, and pretty soon
it's gone.
It's gobbledygook.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Should we call it a night?